State University.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. And Dave, thank you very much. That, out of all the introductions I've received, that's the most recent. Just kidding you. I shouldn't say that, but I am delighted to be here. And Dave and Ann are great friends of mine and great supporters of Ohio State, and have been friends of mine for a very long period of time. And I love Naples, by the way. In fact, I wish I could move my campus down here. Unfortunately, it is found in Ohio and will remain there. But nonetheless, it is a beautiful part of the world. And of course, as you know, many people in the Midwest do come and spend time here. And so in some ways, this feels very much Midwestern, but it has a lot of has a lot of non-Midwestern charm, for which we are for which we're all grateful. Dave, that introduction, I wasn't going to tell this story, but I'll have to because it was an interesting one. It reminds me of a great Ohio story. As you heard, I'm not an Ohioan by birth. I'm a born again Ohioan. Actually, I'm a born again Ohioan, having come back twice. But I have great affection for the state. It's a remarkable place. I was just thinking about the fact that I sat between two great Ohioans a week and a half ago. One's name was John Glenn, and the other's name was Neil Armstrong, the first man to orbit the Earth and the first man to step on the moon. And they're both from very small town Ohio. John Glenn is from New Concord, Ohio, and Neil Armstrong is from Wapakoneta, Ohio. So it has great people doing great things. 11.6 million, in fact. And Dave, I'm reminded of the fact that one of my favorite small cities in Ohio is a city by the name of Chillicothe. And in the early 1900s, they decided that they were going to celebrate their centenary, their 100th anniversary. And so they thought about it and thought about it, and finally they decided they needed to invite a very distinguished Ohioan to come and speak. And they settled on William Howard Taft. Now, those of you who remember your American history know that William Howard Taft was the governor of Ohio, and then the governor general of the Philippines, and then was elected president of the United States, and then ultimately received that highest of recognitions. At least we lawyers believe that. And he was selected to be the Chief Justice of the United States. So the only person in history of this country to serve both the chief elective officer as president and the chief judicial officer as chief justice. And so they send him a telegram. He consents to come. And all of a sudden, they looked around. And unlike Dave, they didn't have anyone distinguished to introduce him. And so they thought about it for a little while. And finally, they settled on a guy that by the name of Chauncey Depew. Chauncey Depew was a New York lawyer turned politician, had become a senator from New York, and then had not been reelected. But instead of going back to New York and practicing law, he went around the country engaging in great oratorical feats and in kind of the tradition of William Jennings Bryan. And so they sent him a telegram, and will you come? And he immediately accepted, and he got up on the day of the speech and started to introduce William Howard Taft. And Chauncey Depew's introduction went on for about 45 minutes. I mean, people are following the soup. Their eyes glazed over. Everything you could possibly imagine happened. And so finally, he turns to him and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I introduce to you the Chief Justice of the United States." Now, one of the things you have to remember about William Howard Taft is not only was he a great American, he was a large American. He weighed well over 300 pounds. He was huge. And so Chauncey Depew turns to him and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I introduce to you the Chief Justice of the United States, a man pregnant with ideas, a man pregnant with creativity." And he sits down, and poor William Howard Taft kind of waddles up to the podium, and he pats his stomach like this. He says, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, if it be a girl, I'll name her Kathleen. If it be a boy, I'll name him William. But if, as I suspect, it be gas, I'll name it Chauncey Depew." So, I don't know why Dave's introduction reminded me of that, but it did, as a matter of fact. And then seeing these wonderful students out here, I was just thinking about my 4 years ago when I returned to Ohio State. There's kind of a humility in being a university president that happens every day. I was thinking, seeing these students who are going to become freshmen, many of them next year, and so I was not even president of the university. I had just kind of arrived on campus, and it was the first day when all the freshmen, and we had all these freshmen running around, and I was walking across the campus, and uh, And I saw these two young ladies, and all of a sudden their eyes lit up, and they said, and one of them's eyes lit up, and I thought, she recognized me. I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. And so I got kind of a jaunt in my step, but I didn't stop to say anything to her, but I nodded to her, and I nodded to her friend, and we looked at each other, and I went on, and about 5 yards after she passed me, I heard her in the loudest whisper. She said, Kathy, she said, wasn't that Orville Redenbacher? So what can I say, huh? Anyway, Dave, thanks for inviting me. And I would just say that one of the reasons is the fact that I'm a great believer in the power of civil discourse, which is what you're about. It's about us talking about ideas, it's about us talking about opportunities and doing it in a civilized way, and I'm grateful for that opportunity to speak to you today. Thinkers and doers and dreamers, I've taken a look at all of your previous speakers and those yet to come, and they come and report on what they've seen and what they've learned, and most importantly, what they can imagine. It's that imagination, that curiosity that seems to me to be driving. So I'm really glad to be here, and obviously I know that someone's out there gathering cards, and they're going to ask some questions. If not, I'll ask you questions. I'm a law professor by training, so I'll do that. But I am grateful. I have been a university president for half my life. If you think about that, that's pretty scary for me and for those that I've served. Great institutions, all West Virginia, University of Colorado, Ohio State, Brown, Vanderbilt, remarkable institutions. And I'm grateful for that opportunity. I feel that it is not a responsibility. I feel that it's a calling. I feel that it's a privilege to do exactly what I'm doing. I now preside over the largest, most complex university in America. 65,000 students, 48,000 faculty and staff, a budget bigger than Rhode Island's and in better shape, I might note. 520,000 living alumni all the way around the world, the largest alumni body. We have students from 88 counties in Ohio and 50 states in our country and 150 countries. We speak 100 different languages, the most multicultural, multi-diverse, multi-dimensional institution in America. We have a permanent station at the South Pole. We have telescopes in South America. We run the agricultural program for the country of Uganda, just to name a few things. So it's a widespread institution, and we love Floridians, and so we want all of these kids here to come. I'm giving your father and mother scholarship, by the way. I'll just say that to them. But one of the things that I do enjoy is the fact that as part of that institution, you can imagine some of the kinds of things that I receive every day. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails from these very bright kids. One of the things that I thought I would do is just share with you some of the most recent ones, just to give you a sense, because I'm always asked, what's it like to be a university president? It's sort of like catching a javelin, but nonetheless, it is that. So I thought I'd just share a couple of these emails, and when I open them up, then I do send back a response to them, but I get so many. This one I thought was very funny. This one came at the beginning of the school year. This is from a freshman by the name of Brent. Dear President Gee, I just saw that Ohio University in Athens has just been named the number one party school in the nation by the Princeton Review. As an incoming freshman at Ohio State, I am very disappointed. I thought Ohio State aspired to be number one in everything. Once I arrive on campus, I will make it my personal mission to improve our party school ranking, just so you know. So what do you do with that one? So I sent him back, no, dear Brent, thanks for your email. Upon further review of your high school transcript and test score, it seems to me we made a mistake in admitting you. I am so sorry. The good news is Ohio University still has a few open spots in his freshman class. Good luck. So I sent him that, and then all of a sudden I realized maybe he didn't realize that was a joke. So I'm out there hunting for him. Is he here? Yes, he was there. And then this one, because there are a couple of other folks in the room that I thought this one would be fun. Dear President Gee, this one came just recently. This is from Alex. As I was driving around campus today, I happened to see some deer out near Kenny Road. I was wondering if a student like me could possibly have the opportunity to hunt on Ohio State-owned land. Dear Alex, sorry but no. Leave the deer alone. Look for wolverines instead. I just thought I would add that one. Okay. There's some Michigan graduates here. That's too bad. One of these days you'll get a great degree. My roommate says that we can earn extra money as human test subjects at the university. This one just arrived. I had to laugh at this one. I want to know if that is true and where we can sign up. We would be good test subjects for any scientist who is doing research on sleep deprivation, pizza consumption, beer drinking, video game playing, or foosball wrist injuries. thank you, and please know we're also going to class and studying. I thought that was helpful. And this one, that came from Matt, and so I sent back a note. Dear Matt, thanks for your note. Unfortunately, the pool of qualified subjects in your specialized area is quite large. But I'm forwarding your email to the Office of Research nonetheless. Good luck, and you might want to lay off the foosball until you pass your final. So I got a great... Anyway, it's wonderful to... It's wonderful to be with all of you, and so I hope I have a chance to answer a few of your questions and talk about the complexities of the world in which we live, and certainly that of higher education. Let me just say as president of a world class public university, it is my good fortune to interact and with some of the brightest minds and most brilliant teachers in the world, and to work in partnership with forward-thinking business leaders and visionary public policymakers. It is challenging, it's exhilarating, it's exciting and wonderful, and often it takes place just before breakfast because that's just the nature of the kind of work I do. I confess, as you heard, that I'm a two-time president of The Ohio State University, and I returned to Ohio State in 2007 because I was convinced it was Ohio State's time. It was this great university's time, and I wanted to be part of one of the most exciting academic environments in American higher education. One of this country's great strengths, ladies and gentlemen, is the breadth and quality of colleges and universities. We have large and small, and public and private. We have Catholic and Mormon. We have a variety of institutions that exist in this place. 3,600 colleges and universities in America. And the strength of the American higher education system is the fact that we are so diverse. You take a look at places like Singapore and Korea and China and other places that perform very well on these K-12 tests. At eighth graders, they perform much better than our eighth graders do. But then all of a sudden, somewhere in their higher education system, our system surpasses them. Of the 50 major universities in the world, 40 are in our country, one, I might note, in Columbus, Ohio. And so we cannot denigrate our system. We need to understand that our higher education system is and continues to be the best in the world. Now, I am a leading economic indicator. I want you to know that. I've changed jobs 6 times, and every time I change a job, the economy plummets. Indeed, it was not... Not long after I returned to Ohio State in late 2007, that the world, as we knew it, began to literally fall apart. The housing market collapsed, forcing families out of their homes. The job market collapsed, creating unprecedented unemployment for millions of Americans. Today, 4.5 years later, after that all happened, things are starting to trend upward slightly. But we all know our country, our state, and certainly our neighbors are still hurting. This is precisely when our nation needs strong and vibrant and engaged colleges and universities. Which leads me to the fundamental premise of what I want to talk about today for just a few minutes, and that is how do these great institutions that we know, how do universities achieve visionary aspirations, which we all have, and continue to flourish in an era of what is very limited funding? And I start out by saying that old models will not survive. The way that universities used to think about themselves will no longer be able to suffice. That I know for certain. In order for us to thrive, we need to rethink, we need to recreate, we need to re-examine, we need to reconfine, we need to reconceptualize a wholly new model, a brave new approach to higher education in the 21st century. This is time for boldness, in my view. It's time for change of the first order. It is time to blaze, in my business, an uncharted future. As you well know, times have irrevocably changed higher education's slice of the pie. Our resources from both the state and federal government are not going to get any bigger. In fact, my own institution, $5 billion, a huge enterprise, only 10% of our budget comes from the state. I joke about the fact that everyone says, well, you're a state-supported university. I say, no, we're state-located. And if I could locate in Naples, I would, but I can't figure out how to make that happen. But time and change demands that we must be infinitely more innovative if we are to sustain our mission and obligation to enhance lives and enrich communities to serve. It is a new year. It's 2012. It is a new reality. It is simply that, because I believe this, and many of you know this better than I, but I do not believe that we're in the middle of a recession. I believe that we're in the middle of a fundamental resetting of the American economic system. Our culture, our values, our directions are all being challenged. And And there is going to be a new reality, and when we deal with that new reality and that new normal, then we'll be able to get on about our work. Too many of my colleagues in higher education and too many of your colleagues in business and industry, they say this will pass and we'll go back to normal. Normal is no longer normal. And so we have to move on. To our great good fortune in Ohio, we have been blessed with strong bipartisan support from our elected officials. Last summer, counter to national and international trends, our governor and our legislature honored the importance of higher education with a budget that supports our mission. And I was grateful for that. We're one of the few institutions in the country that's received that kind of support. And we are almost uniquely fortunate. All but a very few of the 50 states are facing substantial budget gaps, and many have inflicted painful reductions on their institutions. In Florida, this great state that I'm in right now, as you well know, persistent budget reductions have resulted in state university tuition increases of 15% each of the past 4 years. Think about that. The Florida legislature is again, I just looked at it before I came over, expected to eliminate millions of dollars from the higher education budget, and no one will be surprised if tuition is substantially increased just once again. Since 2008, in fact, Florida's state spending on education has dropped by 24%. Your pain, by the way, is shared across the nation. To share just a few other recent examples, one of my very best friends is the president of the University of California, UCLA, Berkeley, etc. I talked to him the other day. They have a $1.2 billion budget deficit in the university. They've let 22,000 people go, and they've faced another budget crisis of major proportions. The University of North Carolina, a great institution, a budget reduction of 50%. My colleagues next door in Pennsylvania had a 30% reduction last year, Penn State, Pitt and Temple, and they face another 30%. It is around the country. And so all of this means that what we have to do is, as university presidents, is we have to fundamentally think differently. So we are, and in so doing, I will say this to all of you, because I do not believe that that is a good sign that we're reducing funding for higher education. What I believe is that we are becoming a nation that risks compromising its democratic foundation of self-governance by an educated people, by continuing to slash education funding in that way. The truth is, we all know that, that the federal and state resources are highly restrained and will continue to be so. We have a $15 trillion budget deficit in Washington. The federal government is an unreliable partner for many reasons, including the fact that they're just an unreliable partner. And I say that as someone who's a jingoistic American, but I am I'm very concerned about that. But also, states are unreliable partners, so therefore we cannot look to them for new resources. So the question is this: how do we, as universities, then think about ourselves? How do we forge forward? What are the kind of things that we need to be doing? And so at Ohio State, we decided to take it in a different way. We decided to think differently about our institution. We decided to turn the telescope around and look at it through a different lens. And so some of the things we're trying to do, if you think about it, is that I believe, first of all, that we need to keep our tuition very moderate. I believe that the American dream should be available to everyone. I am a product of that. Someone today asked me, they said, where are you from? And I was telling the story about a couple of students asked me recently where I'm from. And I said, well, where do you think I'm from? They said, well, you know, you run these massive universities. You've got to be from New York or Chicago or from Los Angeles or somewhere. And I grew up in a very small farming community on the border of Utah and Colorado. Town of 3,000. Very few people would ever hear the name Vernal, V-E-R-N-A-L. I had no television. I had no movie theaters. I read all four of the books in the library. I had done everything you possibly can. I am a personification of the American dream, and I want that available to everyone. I want it available to all these kids. And what happens is sometimes is that we end up not thinking about parents or families. We end up just thinking about the institutions. When I was the president of Brown, it was very simple for me to set tuition. I set it every year by doing one very simple thing. I waited for Harvard to set its tuition. I did mine $100 less. I had no concern whatsoever about parents or families. Now, I'm not saying that as a drag on me. I'm just saying that we didn't think about it that way. In a state in which it's a great land grant university, which is building community and building opportunity, we need to think about moderating tuition. So we can't grow our tuition. We can't continue to charge 15% or 20%. Two out of the last 4 years, we have not raised tuition whatsoever. We have not done that, and I think that is. And so the other side of this, then, if you can't raise tuition, what you have to do is you have to take a look at a number of things. Now, first of all, I'm going to close the door because we want you all to give. The point is raising money is a very important part of that. We need to have our friends become much more engaged with us, and we work very hard on that. The second thing is the fact that we need to make certain that we take advantage of all of the opportunities that we have in terms of our research. Ohio State is the ninth most powerful research institution in this country. We produce more research of quality than all but eight other institutions, but yet we rank at the very bottom in terms of commercialization. Now, you know, I would love to have Gatorade. I admire those guys up north that do this kind of stuff and that. But we don't have that. But we will, and because universities now have to take their ideas and turn them into reality. That's good for them, that's good for their students, that's good for quality, that's good for education, that's good for the brightness of America. And so we have to do that, and we have to be committed to making that happen. The third thing is this, and this is very controversial. I tell everyone, I am not in the business of building cars or building widgets. What is my business? My business is ideas and people. And so therefore, I'm asking the fundamental question of my institution, then why am I in the parking business? Why am I in the airport business? Why am I in the golf course business? Why am I in a variety of other things? And what I want to do, and what I believe we should do, is as institutions, we have to return to our core mission. Our core mission is education. Our core mission is creativity and education. Our core mission is the creation of ideas. Our core mission is ideas and teaching and research and making certain that these young people have great access to those ideas. It's about faculty, staff, and students, and to me it's about 11 million Ohioans and beyond. And so if it doesn't contribute to that, then I'm not certain why I should be in that business. We need to ask those questions. And the final thing we need to do is we need to just become very, very agile and very creative. And this is the conversation I'm having with my friends in the state legislature and my friend the governor, and he is my friend. And I say, look, I tell you what, if you're not going to give us money, give us freedom in the Mosaic sense. You know, if you're not going to give us money, let us be able to manage ourselves in a way that we do so responsibly. We just had this program last year this option that we got through the state legislature. Ohio was the last state in which you could really build buildings in a most creative way. We had a 137-year-old law about construction, a law that was passed before Mark Twain wrote Huckleberry Finn. Now that's not very creative, if you ask me. And it was passed to build canals. And now we're building huge hospitals. I've been building the most of technologically. I'm going to get this right. I haven't been drinking, by the way. I'm just the most technologically advanced hospital in the country, $1 billion hospital. And I convinced the legislature. We convinced the legislature. This is not an imperial we. The way that my good friend John Hall is right here at Vanderbilt, we could build those buildings 3 years faster at 30% less, just by being in. By doing it another way. And so think about that. There's a $300 million saving to the people of Ohio and to the university by just getting that turned around. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make certain that we get that kind of freedom. And the other thing, of course, is to make certain that we are very agile ourselves. Universities are huge bureaucracies. We have auditors auditing auditors and lawyers looking over each other's shoulders, and the end result is the fact that we take no risk. We get in the foxholes, and we end up saying we can't do that. Someone says something to me all the time. They say, well, you can't do that, Mr. President. I say, why? And they say, well, that's not the way we do things at Ohio State, as if Woody Hayes was still walking the damn campus. It's not true. He doesn't walk the campus, and I can do it differently, and we can. You know, Ohio State is an elephant, and we need to be a ballerina, not an elephant with a tutu. And so we have to change the way that we think about things. At the same time, we have to realize that uh, that uh, that there are certain things that are very traditional, and we have to honor those traditions. We have the world's greatest band. I'll say this to those who enjoy bands. We have the best damn band in the land, and it is that. Wins every award, as a matter of fact. So I'm not going to change the band. We still play football. We'll still do that. A number of other things. But what we will change is we'll change those things that are imperative in order to get ourselves in order. I've also committed to our Board of Trustees that we will allocate or change or make ourselves more nimble, and I will reallocate $1 billion over the next 5 years, more than any university in America. And that is what we have to do in order to be competitive. And the reason for that is very simple. Because if we continue to do things the same way, what we'll do, we will manage ourselves into decline. We have to be the architects of change, or else we'll be victimized by it. We have to make certain that in order to make those kinds of changes that we're doing the right things in the right way. So those are the things that I think are important. And that is the business of the American University. We have to be in the business of ideas. We will break down the barriers that impede us. We will regain our confidence as a nation through the American university system. We will find a new way forward. We will thrive, because I believe that universities are to this century what the great smokestacks were of the last century. We're now in a world of ideas. I was saying this to someone last night, and I love to think about this. When in the year 1900, the richest man in the world was a guy by the name of Carnegie or Vanderbilt or Rockefeller. And they earned their living off of extracted industries, off of steel and off of coal and a variety of other things. The richest man in the world today is a guy by the name of Bill Gates. He is a college dropout. I do not recommend that, by the way. I want you to know that. But everything he's earned his living off of was invented in universities. We're idea factories. The computer, the internet, everything was invented in universities. And now universities are the economic engine that will drive this country. I'm going to India on Tuesday. 1.2 billion Indians by the year 2050, there will be 2 billion Indians. 1.3 billion Chinese, just by the sheer mass against 330 million Americans. We will never win that race. The race we will win is the race of ideas. And that is what makes universities now so critical. They move from places where you send your sons and daughters to have a good time, join a fraternity and sorority, and come home and get a real job, to being the center of what our future is. If this is to be the American century, the 21st century, then we have to make it the century of ideas, and we have to do it through investing in those ideas in our colleges and universities. And so this is a great country with the greatest universities, and the future is ours to claim if we're willing to look at it. And so I want to return to a note that I to someone that I talked about a little bit earlier, and that was John Glenn. He's 90 years old. His wife is 91. They will be married 69 years in April. Annie Glenn, some of you remember the story. Annie Glenn was an 85% stutterer, could not communicate at all. They met at age 2 in a crib, literally. They grew up in this little town together. And they met, and it was a love story that has continued. But for many years, they couldn't communicate. They communicated by smiling and laughing and by holding hands. What a great story. And so you think about that. You think about the fact that the themes of his life story, prototypically American, in the very finest sense, they center around small-town Ohio roots. Selflessly answering when his country called, daring to do literally the impossible in uncharted territory, remaining unswervingly devoted to his wife and to his children, and stepping up again to serve in the United States Senate. John Glenn never said no. He never said, "I would rather not," which is unfortunately what all too many people are saying now. That great spirit resonates with our students, and I assure you that it resonates with almost everyone that I'm around. Do you remember this? I remember this. I remember sitting on the edge of my seat and hearing those immortal words from the NASA Mission Control. Remember, John Glenn went up in a Roman candle. No one thought it was going to fly. Even the German scientists didn't think it was going to fly. And so he goes up and he sat. And we're sitting there in NASA Mission Control when they said, "Godspeed, John Glenn." I still remember that as profoundly today as when I was a young man. I was 18 at the time. So now in 2012, our students were, when they listened to him tell that story, were pin drop quiet. They were mesmerized by this giant in our nation's history who stood before them and told them to reach for the stars. And that is what we have to do now. We have to again have American heroes. We have to again believe in ourselves. We have to believe that the greatness of our country is found in the individual worth of the individuals that make a difference. And that is what the American University is about. These great land-grant institutions, Ohio State being the largest and I believe the best of those, are made to make certain that the American dream is available to everyone. And the American dream does live through education. So, saying all of that, I'd like to have your comments and take any of your questions, if I may. Okay, you got those.
Oh, thank you, Gordon. And we do have a couple gifts for you to take home.
Two books.
I'll give them to Jeff. The Marco Island book, it's donated by one of our members, and a book on Naples, Florida for
Good.
You to take with you.
Thank you.
We have many, many questions, and I apologize. We're not going to be able to get to all of them, but I'll try to consolidate a lot. And the first one I think I want to ask, maybe I'll answer. Do you feel salaries for university presidents are getting too high?
know,
I should have saved that one for last.
No, I think that's a great one. I will say this. This is a very interesting story. I will admit this. I'm the highest paid university president in the country. As a public university president, my goal is to make as much money as my football coach. When I do that, then I'll feel like I'm highly paid. How does that sound? Okay.
I get to add to that. Remember, I said a $5 billion budget. How many CEOs of major companies? You talk about $5 billion budgets. I mean, that doesn't even compare to what the CEOs of some of the companies get. Here's one I know the answer to, and I get to answer it. Okay. The question comments about what I said was the graduation rate of from the time the student enters till the graduation. The question was, what's the graduation of football players? I can mention it real quick. Remember I said national average graduation rate is 57%. Football players at Ohio State is 62%. All sports combines 83%, just for your information, okay? And they have more intramural sports, I think, than about any one of five.
36, yes, we have the largest athletic program in the country. Dave, I'll just sit down while you continue to answer the questions. How does that sound?
I'm saving your voice. I'm saving your voice.
That's okay. All right. I'm having a good time up
Are
here.
Are you ready? Are you ready? Here you go. I got a good one for you. How about a few comments on football, past, present, and future?
Yeah,
okay,
football.
Go for
okay,
it.
Okay.
We have probably have 10
well, you know,
cards.
You know, we had our. I tell everyone, as you know, Ohio State had some problems last year. I feel like I've been through a year-long colonoscopy, actually, without anesthesia. But I would point out that we did come out on the other end because of the fact we. That was not meant to come out that way. I can assure you, cut that one out. But I can assure you that what we learned through that is the fact that even though football represents 0.25% of my budget, it takes about 90% of our oxygen sometimes, and which is too bad. I mean, I and these sports writers, these guys from ESPN, were talking to me the other day, and they said, "Well, why is all that?" And now that we're kind of through this whole process, I said, "Well, the minute that we see our newspapers, the Naples, what is it? What's the name of the
Naples Daily?
The Naples Daily News, the New York Times, when they have a academic section or an English section instead of a sports section, we're going to change that." We're going to change that, but until we do, until they put all the attention on that, then that's not going to take place. In our instance, we learned a lot. We believe that our integrity remains intact. We took our medicine. We hired a great Ohioan, Urban Meyer, to come back and to be our coach. He's from Ashtabula County in Ohio, and his wife was Miss Ross County. So we want you to know that. We're glad to have him back, and thanks for training him. We appreciate that.
Next question. Would college degrees be less expensive if more online classes were online?
Yeah, I think, there's the click and brick example, and we have to talk a lot about that. You know, I get really upset. I'm watching the Big Ten Network the other day, and every once in a while when I'm watching, this young lady comes on, she says, "I'm in my pajamas and I'm getting a college degree." Young lady, you're not getting a college degree, you're getting something. But you're not getting a college degree, because a college degree is much more than just a degree. The most important thing for these young people is going to be what happens outside the classroom. The greatest learning experience in an American university is the fact that you're around really bright people and you're having this conversation, the crucible of ideas and activities. I tell everyone, the students, the freshman students, are on our campus 168 hours a week, of which there are 8 hours, and they're in class 18 hours, but the 150 hours is the most important learning experience, and that's when they get together and when they really do formulate a vision of their future. So online is important as an adjunct, but as a central core way for us to create an economically viable system in this country, it will never work.
Next, there are a lot of questions on tuition costs and how much they've increased. You touched on that during your remarks, but why have they doubled so fast? What's the future tuition costs without, again, less in state aid, sections?
Yeah, well, let me talk. Tuition is an interesting thing. Now, I told you, in the private institutions, we didn't care much about it. Lots of applicants. People would sell their first child to come, a variety of other things. I think that some of them did. But in the public and in the public universities, we're very concerned about that. First of all, public the cost price index in this country, and I don't need to explain this; these are very smart people here, is made up of a lot of cost price indexes. It's just not one; it's a multiple. There are about 33 of them, and the higher education price index is among the highest of those, because we're very people intensive, we're very computer intensive, we're very research intensive, all those kinds of things. And so our price index is higher than CPA. But when you take a look at it, we just did this recently. Take a look at the cost of a Chevrolet in 1965, and of a tuition at Ohio State. Our costs are less than the rising cost of a Chevrolet. And so let's just get realistic about it. There has been an inflationary moment in this country. Prices have gone up, and universities are part of that. Now, saying that, I believe we need to keep our prices very moderate. I chair the National Commission on the Future of the American University. We are meeting on Monday. And our number one issue is, how do we make certain that there is both access and affordability for the American student? And I think that that is our number one issue.
Next question. An ever percentage of high school grads are not really prepared for college. How can that be fixed?
Well, you know, I wish I had a magic elixir. We rank 36th in the world now in K through 12 in terms of our achievement rates. We used to rank number one. Now, does that mean that our system has gotten worse? No, it means that everyone else is catching up. This competition is very intense. And as I said, in some of those countries, in Singapore, in Korea, in a number of other places, they're very intense in terms of what they do at the K through 12 level. And higher education, then all of a sudden we surpass them again, and we will continue to do that, in my belief. But I think there are a couple of things we have to do. We've got to get our kids going to school beyond 180 days a year. I think that's absurd that they go 180 days. They go from 8 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. They have breaks all the time. I believe that we need to believe in homework. I believe that we need to have our students go to class about 270 days a year. I think we need to extend our days in terms of what they're doing. I think that we need to provide opportunities in terms of education, which is about education, not about a number of kinds of things. Now, we have two very good high schools here, and I'm not condemning anyone, but I'm saying that we have to get serious about K through 12. We have to reward teachers. You know, right now, what happens in this country, we say, hey, listen, if you can't be a doctor, you can't be a lawyer, you can't be an engineer, you can always be a teacher. The Germans say, if you can't be a teacher, you can be a doctor or an engineer. That's what we have to do. We have to change the whole calculus. The most important person in this country is the math teacher who teaches our kids in the seventh grade. And they ought to be rewarded for it. They ought to be paid more than football coaches and university presidents. That's what we need to do. Then we'll have that kind of success. And by the way, let me just also finish this. The other thing is, we've turned our public schools into Red Cross units. We've turned them into babysitting units, a variety of other things. What we have to do, there is no substitute for good homes and good families and caring parents and good communities and synagogues and churches. We have to get back to those fundamental premises. That's where education starts. It doesn't start in the classroom. It starts in that attitude, and I think that's important.
We have a number of questions from students, and I wish we could go through them all, but time doesn't permit. I do want to ask this one. You have seen many freshmen over the years. What is the one thing you recommend and suggest to an incoming freshman should do to succeed?
I think be curious. I love the word. I think curiosity is something that we don't have enough of. We tend to be really, really dogmatic. I mean, this is not meant to be a political comment, but it'll sound like it. The debates we have going on in this country show no curiosity whatsoever. They're so dogmatic and so far to the left and so far to the right that I'm sick about it, you know. I mean, think about our founding fathers. Thomas Jefferson was the most curious man in America. And we need to have that curiosity again. And that's what I say to our kids. Develop curiosity and treat the world in a curious way, and you're going to be very successful.
I have two similar questions regarding the current administration. Two of them focus on almost the same thing, that the current president seems to question the value of pursuing higher education. And do you have any response?
Well, not
to that?
The current president. It's a senator from Pennsylvania who questions that. President.
I'm reading the question, sir.
Okay. Well, you get it right.
I have problems. I have problems. I went to Ohio State.
Yeah,
I don't always get it right.
The senator from Pennsylvania, the former senator from Pennsylvania, has said that it's kind of that higher education is irrelevant. Let me just say this: the difference between a college degree and a high school degree in this country is between $1 million and $2 million in earning power, and it's growing. The difference between a high school degree and a college degree in this country is also the difference in our creative energy that will make us a viable nation. So don't tell me that. I have problems. I'm with the current administration. I think that they're politicizing the debate over tuition. I hate that. That's unfortunate. They ought to get a life themselves. And the previous administration, the Bush administration, they passed this No Child Left Behind, which had everyone teaching toward kids taking tests instead of toward thinking. I mean, it's not a Republican or a Democratic thing. Everyone has made a mess out of this, and we've got to get this right here in the next period of time.
Okay, we're down to a couple more questions. How about a quick answer on how do you afford a ratio of 47,000 staff to 65,000 students?
Because of the fact we run big hospitals, we have the largest academic medical center in the country, and it takes a lot of cancer surgeons and so forth to do the kinds of things that we're doing. So that includes everyone. Our student faculty ratio is about 10 or 11 to 1, which is for a big public university is better than almost any. The student-faculty ratio at Vanderbilt was 9 to 1, at Brown was 9 to 1, so we have Ivy League quality in our undergraduate educational experience.
Okay, I have two final questions. The first one is from a student. Did you ever expect that you were going to be in the place you are today?
No.
That's the reason I can ask
you. No, I thought I was going to be pumping gas in Vernal, Utah, and if I continue to make mistakes as a university president, I might be doing that, this is interesting. First of all, I'm an accidental university president. I was the dean of a law school, and I was young, very young at the time, and the president of West Virginia University left to be the chancellor of the University of Kansas, and they looked around, they decided they wanted to have a lawyer as president, and I was the only one available, and so I really got the job. I was too young. I always tell everyone the greatest mistake that I've made as university president was taking the job. It's been a wonderful life. No one could be more blessed than I've been. I've been privileged to do what I do, but at the same time, I missed a whole level of my life. I had a very young daughter. She was 3 at the time. My wife was getting her PhD. My wife unfortunately died when my daughter was 15. I really feel that in some ways that I should have had a more balanced life, and so it's been a blessing, but it's also been a challenge.
Final question. You served as president of four schools, five presidencies.
No, five schools, six presidencies.
Five presidencies. You know, I told you I can't count.
That's all right. Dave's great.
Regardless, you've had the title president so many times. Why don't you run for president of the United States?
Oh, right. Let me tell you something. Let me make a comment. This is political. And that is the fact that we beat the best people out of wanting to run by the kind of intense, insane scrutiny we put people under. The very best people will not rise to the challenge to take on the most important jobs in the country unless we can get this thing right, and we have to get it right. And I believe that we will. I mean, I'm an optimist. I believe that we will. But really, the kind of blogging and scrutiny and insane negativity is un-American, in my view. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Gordon. See you in 2 weeks. Don't forget to leave your name badges on the way out. Bye-bye.